AM Amory and WBZH 910 AM W245 CT Hayward.
Always streaming on the Civic
ABC
Media
News,
app.
I'm Brian Clark. Congressman Matt Gaetz tells ABC's This Week he's going to move this week to remove House Speaker Kevin McCarthy from his position. Made those comments a day after McCarthy used Democratic support to avert a government shutdown of the deal that was passed. Gaetz, who opposed it, said,
"It wasn't a surrender by the MAGA wing. We lost. A defeat is not a surrender. There were 90 Republicans who voted against this bad deal, and we did not prevail."
Congressman Jamal Bowman of New York apologized after the Democrat was seen on video pulling a fire alarm in a Capitol Hill office building Saturday ahead of a vote. He said the door that was locked is usually open during the week. Republicans are calling for discipline. About 28 million student loan borrowers have to resume their payments to the federal government today as the pandemic pause comes to an end. And our partners at ESPN say Buffalo Bills safety Damar Hamlin expected to be active for today's game for the first time since he suffered cardiac arrest during a January game. This is ABC News. The civil trial involving former President Trump begins tomorrow in New York. He and his company is facing a $250 million lawsuit from the state attorney general's office over allegedly falsifying business records to inflate the value of assets. Former president denies wrongdoing. Tens of thousands of ethnic Armenians continue to stream into the country after fleeing a disputed territory with Azerbaijan. ABC's Patrick Reval explains.
This can only be described as large-scale ethnic cleansing. Over 100,000 ethnic Armenians have now fled the disputed enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh. That means virtually the enclave's entire population has now left, abandoning their homes after Azerbaijan, backed by Turkey, recaptured the region with a military offensive last week. Families are taking only what they can hold. They've been streaming into Armenia. Old people, young children, traveling often exposed to the weather.
A United Nations mission's arrived in Nagorno-Karabakh. Brian Clark, ABC News.
Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station. As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
He shouldn't even have BLTs. That are a terrible sandwich.
Oh, I love BLTs. That's
so
like
do
one,
I.
The one deli sandwich I could have.
Greg, don't yuck my yum, dude.
I will.
We've already established on this show today that Greg is happy to judge people's yums.
Bring me your yums, for I am the yum judge.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Brock. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Looking for more local programming? Check out our website, civicmedia.us, to see our entire lineup.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Fall is here, and many people are making decisions about their health insurance. Experts say consulting with people you trust can make the process easier. Here's Mike Moan.
Enrollment period starts November 1st for Wisconsin's health insurance marketplace tied to the Affordable Care Act. For employer-sponsored coverage, it's typically between September and December. And for Medicare, annual enrollment runs from October 15th through December 7th. Allison Epseseth leads Covering Wisconsin, which has navigators who provide unbiased information for free on a lot of these topics. They also can calm nerves about assumptions that all insurance is too expensive.
There are always new plans coming on the marketplace, especially Wisconsin has a really robust number of plans available.
She also notes that 90% of people who turn to the marketplace for private coverage get financial assistance to help cover their premiums. If you currently have insurance, she said navigators can also help with errors such as being billed incorrectly for certain care. Dr. Rhonda Randall with United Healthcare says comparing plans and taking time to learn the basic insurance vocabulary are critical for understanding your benefits.
We have a tool called Just Plain Clear. It's a glossary that you can find online. And for our Medicare Advantage members, a companion called Medicare Made Clear.
And for people without employer-sponsored insurance, predicting income can be difficult for the year ahead. So if you're a seasonal worker or an independent contractor, make an effort to estimate your income based on this year's invoices or pay stubs, and to use any help available to get you through the complicated process of choosing health coverage. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
And you're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
On Friday, it was Sam's first day flying solo because Aaron said he was going bear hunting. Aaron's not here this morning.
He's
so
not.
It's either Aaron doesn't need to be here or Aaron's been eaten by a bear.
Gosh, I'd sure hope that Aaron hasn't been eaten by a bear.
Well, he's not there. Now I'm just afraid that if we ring up his phone somewhere out there, Mrs. Bear is going to elbow Mr. Bear and go, is your tummy rumbling?
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday mornings 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Welcome back to this, our second hour on Saturday, September 30th. This is our 65th broadcast here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Delighted to have you with me once again for this, our weekly review, our analysis, our discussion, our conversation of the big stories in law and government and the aspiration for justice in America. As always, taking your phone calls, your questions, your comments, both through text, through the Civic Media online website. Find your broadcast station, find Morning Cannolis folder, and send us your notes. And also taking your phone calls, again, at 844-967-2789. As in this hour, we turn to some of the major developments in the litigation involving our former president in New York, in Georgia, and then in turn to other issues related to things like the 14th Amendment and false electors, finally filling out the hour by talking about what we can expect in this coming term of the United States Supreme Court, the new term, first Monday in October, beginning this coming Monday. But before we get to all of that, let's go to the phones and take a caller. Mark, you've been on the line for a while. Your comment or your question here this morning on Morning Cannolis.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, Jim. But I find it ironic, you know, a few points this morning. I was just checking on my little handy copy of the Constitution along with the Federalist Papers, that actually the 27th Amendment says that no law varying the compensation for the services of for the senators and representatives shall take effect until an election of representatives shall have intervened. Well, I'd say that just says they can't change the rate of pay rather than they get paid during this shutdown. I mean, I'd make the argument for that these guys are going to continue to get paid while the shutdown goes on, and some of their staffs will be paid and others of them will not be paid, which I think is tremendously unfair. But I don't think that any of those guys should be getting paid if the checks are not getting cut for other governmental employees. And I would say that other governmental employees would include those in the executive branch as well as the Supreme Court, that if nobody's getting paid, then nobody should be getting paid. Right. And I'm probably wrong in that interpretation. And also for the district redistricting cases in the various states, some of this traces back to our failure to enforce the had to look it up this morning, but the Enforcement Acts of 1870 and 1871, where we were actually enforcing the constitutional amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, emphasis on the 14th Amendment, both in the redistricting cases, as it applies to the states of Alabama and Louisiana, but also here in the state of Wisconsin, where I say it's clear that here in the state of Wisconsin, not only should they be reinforcing that for the 14th Amendment, Section 2, in terms of the fake electors here in the state of Wisconsin. Josh Call, if you're listening, it's your constitutional duty to go after the fake electors because they attempted to abridge the rights of the state of people here in the state of Wisconsin, but also to our state Supreme Court, who has failed to uphold the Constitution, where it says that our district is supposed to be compact and contiguous. And I believe I heard on this very network where over 50% of our districts are not contiguous or compact.
Right. Mark, all great points. Let's unpack a couple of those. Absolutely. 27th Amendment, going back to this issue related to the budget and the failure of our Congress and political people in Washington, D.C. to put together a budget for all of us. 27th Amendment is interpreted to ensure that members of Congress continue to get paid. Interesting, a lot of reporting. Members of Congress recognize the incongruity and the inconsistency of that. We've got somebody like Sean Kasten, who's a Democrat of Illinois. He's offering pay advances to his staffers. Again, they're not covered by the 27th Amendment, who would stop receiving paychecks effectively tonight, but certainly on Monday. An intern for Representative Abigail Spanberger, who's a Democrat of Virginia, compiling a list of food banks and financial resources display on her website in case the office there is shuttered. The White House, obviously the Budget Office, sending information to all federal agencies, executive branch, others out there, anticipating that this will happen and that we're going to have federal employees not paid for the work that they are doing. And in some cases, again, being sent home, as I said before, sending that horrific message not only to them as good and decent government workers, but also to all of us, that because Congress, in the hands of these partisan folks in the House of Representatives, cannot pass a budget, our government once again coming to its knees, appropriate under the 27th Amendment to interpret it, Mark, the way that you have, regrettably, beyond the 27th Amendment, basic decency, a basic sense of balance across government would indicate, gosh, if the government is not functioning, perhaps nobody should get paid, including those folks who continue to serve in these capacities with pay under the law. Second, with respect to the fake electors and 14th Amendment, we're going to talk about those things later in this hour, so I appreciate your focusing on those in particular, Mark. A part of our continuing, yes, enforcement of the Constitution of the United States of America, the Voting Rights Act, and other things right here in the state of Wisconsin that likewise we should be focusing on. Let's go back. Let's go back to Washington, D.C. and talk about, again, this major case that is pending federally in the U.S. District Court in the District of Columbia. Judge Tanya Chutkan is going to be addressing in the weeks just ahead these issues related to whether the so-called gag order should be imposed, a continuing dispute between the former president, who is the singular defendant in that case, and the representatives, the legal representatives of the U.S. Department of Justice, maintaining that the judge needs to tell Donald Trump to stop talking about the potential jurors, witnesses in ways that could compromise the jury pool, could have an impact upon the conduct of justice, the conduct of the trial, which he has set for early 2024. That coming up in a couple of weeks. Significantly, just this past week, a couple of other major things having to do with Donald Trump's other problems in state courts that I want to spend some time talking about. Arguably the biggest news item, rule of law item of this past week, having to do with what a state judge in Manhattan, in New York, did in connection with a civil case that has been pending against Donald Trump and his company and two of his children for a long period of time. Just this past week, Judge Arthur Engoron, we've talked a lot about him. He is the trial judge in New York who is supervising, administering this major case brought by Letitia James, who is the attorney general of the state of New York, alleging that over a period of time, that Donald Trump and his company overvalued holdings by as much as $2.2 billion, real estate principally, varying the valuations of those depending upon who he's talking to, what applications he's making for insurance purposes, for tax purposes, all sorts of overvaluing, undervaluing, movement of amounts and figures and math inside the books of the Trump Organization that are violative of New York state law. And again, Letitia James, as a part of her enforcement responsibilities, brings this lawsuit against Donald Trump, against his children, and it seeks not only about $250 million in penalties, but also a directive, an injunctive order that would prevent Donald Trump and his children and others from ever being involved in corporate review, oversight, management in New York in the future. So what happened just this past week? Again, a major matter in the litigation that the former president is presently facing, regarded as a major victory for the attorney general there in this lawsuit against him. The attorney general had argued that, again, Trump had inflated the value of his properties. And indeed, Judge Engoron embraced that notion. He said that the annual financial statements that Donald Trump submitted to banks and insurance companies clearly contain fraudulent valuations that the defendants, again, Donald Trump and his sons, used in business. And significantly went on to talk about the ways in which the information there is compelling and overwhelming. The reason why this case is not only significant is because, of course, the findings in particular that the judge entered at this time, but also because of the mechanism for doing this. When I first heard this, I thought, gosh, what's happening to the trial that is scheduled to begin again on Monday, a big day in the history of America coming up for a number of different reasons, right? This coming Monday, the 2nd of October. Judge Engoron had scheduled this way back when and said, his own words, not mine, come hell or high water, we're going to pick a jury on Monday morning. He was absolutely committed to doing this. And so the initial news that he had already found that that Donald Trump and others had committed this fraud and was stripping control of the company from him struck me as significant. And I thought, gosh, what's going to happen to the trial next week? Well, it turns out that the findings by the judge are even more significant because of the mechanism, the civil procedure mechanism that this reveals. There's something called summary judgment, not in the criminal cases, but in civil cases, where if it turns out that the facts are undisputed, that everybody looks at the facts and says, you know what, this is compelling, this is overwhelming, there is no factual dispute for a jury to decide, a judge can enter summary judgment, finding that the facts are absolutely clear, and the law also is clear in its application to those facts. And that's exactly what Judge Engoron did. And so he enters this order that says, as a matter of law, as a matter of fact, there's no jury that I need to bring in to review this. It is clear. Any trier of fact will find that indeed this fraud was committed and that the case brought by Letitia James is compelling. All of this, as a part of his major ruling just this past week. In that order, Judge Engoron wrote scathingly in making this important decision about the defenses that were being presented by Donald Trump and his attorney. He said that the former president and these other defendants, including the two adult sons, ignored reality when it suited their business needs, the judge said. In defendants' world, again, this is Judge Engoron writing in this major opinion, granting summary judgment as to the facts and the law. He says, rent-regulated apartments are worth the same as unregulated apartments. Restricted land is worth the same as unrestricted land. And restrictions can evaporate into thin air. That, according to the judge, all of that in the defendants' world. And goes on to say, this is a fantasy world, not the real world. That's compelling language from any judge, again, in this major decision, shutting down these defenses by Donald Trump, by his organization, and by his sons. And along the way, saying that the only thing left, the reason why there still will be a trial on Monday, is not in the facts of whether or not there's fraud here, but whether or what exactly should happen with respect to damages. And indeed, the Attorney General, Letitia James, sent a brief statement. We look forward to presenting our case, the rest of our case, at trial coming up on Monday. And when we come back after this break, I'll tell you what that's going to be all about. Tell you a little bit more about what's going to happen as this case goes forward. Then we go to Georgia and talk about the other major rule of law thing happening out of that case pending in the Georgia courts. Stay with us for that discussion.
Medicare open enrollment starts October 15th. Countless mailers and TV commercials will tell you you're missing out on some benefits. But don't be tricked into an Advantage plan you don't need or that doesn't cover your current medication. Wisconsin Senior Medicare Patrol can help you prevent, detect, and report Medicare fraud. Visit Wisconsin Senior Medicare Patrol online at smpwi.org.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Do you support the legalization, regulation, and taxation of legal cannabis in the state of Wisconsin? You said yes, Melissa. That was like 12 years ago. What do you think the hangup is?
It's the Republicans. They're suffering from reefer madness. They're out of touch legislators in the Capitol building who don't want to give a win to Governor Evers and Democrats.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6 on your local civic media radio station and on the app. Under the helmet with the gravedigger, Gilbert Brown.
Jordan Love was 15 for 27 for 245 yards and 3 TDs against a JV team.
Oh, my God. I mean, I don't like Chicago, but I ain't going to call them a JV team. They suck, but it's a slap in the face. Okay. I'm laughing at y'all Bear fans.
I know, man.
Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger with Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram. Monday mornings at 8 on your local civic media radio station and on the app.
The Green Bay Packers call Lambeau Field home, but did you know the stadium has a history all its own? It started with where to build it. Residents on both sides of the city wanted it. Officials argued there had to be room for growth. Eventually, farmland was purchased, but in Ashwaubenon. The bargaining continued, and in 1956, the land was annexed to Green Bay. Green Bay City Stadium became a reality the following year and was renamed in honor of team co-founder and coach Curly Lambeau in 1965. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Ball.
Civic Media radio stations providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
About this major written decision, a paper decision issued by a state court judge in New York State, handing a major victory to Attorney General Letitia James in her major lawsuit against Donald Trump, his sons, his company, finding that Trump committed fraud in the evaluation of assets, insurance deals, loans, those kinds of things, and also stripping control of key properties from him. During the course of this order, scathingly writing about what the evidence shows and saying along the way that the lawyers who also made arguments in support of the former president also should be sanctioned. He levied sanctions against the lawyers for making arguments that he had previously rejected. And specifically, Judge Engoron said that each of those lawyers has to pay $7,500, noting that he had previously warned them specifically about not making these frivolous arguments in court. He revisited them again in this order and said that their positions bordered on being frivolous. Repeating them, he said, is indefensible. So in addition to this major order finding fraud by Trump and others, also sanctioning the attorneys for continuing to make arguments to the contrary. Again, all of this is a part of this major lawsuit going to trial, again, no longer on the merits of whether there was fraud. That's what Judge Engoron has found, but to determine by a jury exactly what the damages should be here. And so in the coming days, you're going to hear about a jury being impaneled in front of Judge Engoron in the Superior Court there in the state of New York, not about whether there's fraud, but asking the jury to figure out how much money, what are the damages amount of this, even as the judge already strips control of these key properties from Trump and his company, the organization, the LLC itself, all of that going ahead. One noteworthy example, as a part of this disposition here, the attorney general there accused Donald Trump of overestimating the size of a triplex apartment in Trump Tower, which we've seen a lot. He used that for decades for one of his residents. He said it was 30,000 feet rather than about 11,000 feet. Judge Engoron seized on that, among other things. He noted that Trump's lawyers had absurdly suggested that the calculation of square footage was subjective, and adding that good faith measurements might vary by as much as 10 to 20%, but not 200%. That, again, the reason for imposing not only penalties upon the lawyers for making those kinds of ridiculous arguments, but finding unequivocally that Donald Trump, in this major piece of litigation, guilty of fraud, civil fraud, not criminally. But again, a second major case. Recall that in the case involving E. Jean Carroll, her allegations of rape, of sexual assault back in the 1990s, the defamation that followed. Also Donald Trump suffering a major civil blow in those cases as well. All of these coming together at a time when the defendant, Donald Trump, also facing criminal cases in Manhattan by the DA there based upon the hush money case. They're also facing, of course, federal cases involving January 6th and the Mar-a-Lago documents. And then also coming out of Georgia. And let's turn to that case as well. That's the case where Fannie Willis in Fulton County has brought this 19-defendant case against these defendants, alleging that not only in the Fulton County, but throughout the state of Georgia, these particular defendants, including many of them by name, including Jeffrey Clark, had attempted very closely to try to undermine the election there, to overthrow the votes cast legitimately by residents of that state, and describing in great detail all the kinds of things, including fake electors there, also charged there with their violations of state law. Just this past week, a couple more important things happened in that case that are very big, that are going to change the geography of that case. We have a federal district court judge whose name is Steve Jones. We've talked about him before. He has been entertaining these requests by various defendants there, including Mark Meadows in the past, and three others, including Jeffrey Clark and some of the GOP electors who were indicted along with Donald Trump, to move their cases from federal court to state court. And Steve Jones previously telling Mark Meadows, nope, there's no basis upon which to do that. The things that are alleged in this state court indictment do not partake of things that you have done in the course of your duties and responsibilities as a federal officer, in Mark Meadows' case as the chief of staff. Likewise, this past week, with respect to Jeffrey Clark's similar claim that what he was doing at the time in January of 2021, at that time, the things he was doing were a part of his duties and responsibilities. The judge specifically rejects all that. And recall that last Saturday, we talked a lot about Jeffrey Clark, his attempts not only through the former president, through the Department of Justice, to send letters to states, including Georgia, suggesting that there had been voter fraud there, all those kinds of things coming out of Jeffrey Clark's office. And attempting actually to assume the responsibilities of the attorney general to get an appointment by the president to accomplish all of this. All of that set forth also in the state court indictment. Jeffrey Clark, as a result of his petition in court this past week and being told by the judge, Steve Jones there, that Clark has submitted no evidence that the letter that he was writing as a part of his job was overseeing environmental litigation or in his role as the acting head of the civil division, nothing official, no official capacity activities, just the opposite. At a minimum, political activities, campaign activities, and also, according to the indictment, of course, criminal activities. The judge saying, to the contrary, the evidence before the court indicates the opposite. Clark's role in the civil division did not include any role in the investigation of oversight of state elections, rejecting Clark's attempt to bring the case from the state court into the federal court. Along the way, the same thing happens with respect to three others. The electors also, of course, they were also charged in this case, rejecting the requests from Georgia Republican Party Chairman David Schaefer, State Senator Sean Still, and Kathy Latham, who also argued that their so-called federal roles should protect them from state charges. Again, a ridiculous notion. The judge summarily rejecting that as well and saying, no, you stay in state court, bringing to an end at least this portion of the litigation, going ahead, plainly, with the prosecution now in state court of these state charges pending there in Georgia. And in that connection, the other major issue coming out of that case as well, and that is the first plea among the 19, a fellow named Scott Hall. And when we come back, we're going to talk about Scott Hall's plea in the state court, why that's so critical, why that's so important, and talk more about the future of that case in the state of Georgia. Stay with us for that continuing discussion of this case.
This summer, Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK has a new starting lineup. Beginning at 6, Up North News. Then at 8, Stu Daniels on Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Congressman Matt Gaetz tells ABC's This Week he's going to move this week to remove House Speaker Kevin McCarthy from his position. Made those comments a day after McCarthy used Democratic support to avert a government shutdown. Of the deal that was passed, Gaetz, who opposed it, said,
"It wasn't a surrender by the MAGA wing. We lost. A defeat is not a surrender. There were 90 Republicans who voted against this bad deal, and we did not prevail."
Congressman Jamal Bowman of New York apologized after the Democrat was seen on video pulling a fire alarm in a Capitol Hill office building Saturday ahead of a vote. He said the door that was locked is usually open during the week. Republicans are calling for discipline. About 28 million student loan borrowers have to resume their payments to the federal government today as the pandemic pause comes to an end. And our partners at ESPN say Buffalo Bills safety DeMar Hamlin expected to be active for today's game for the first time since he suffered cardiac arrest during a January game. This is ABC News.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
Aaron comes in every day looking like he just stepped out of a Turkish bathhouse because it's so hot in there. Just to recap, so far this segment has been filled with dog vomit, old men peeing, and Aaron wearing a dish towel. So we're...
Hey man, your name's on the show. Your name's on the show.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday mornings 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
My name is Teresa Barber. I was in the United States Navy, and I served overseas in the Middle East and Africa. Early on in my career, I had a commander that taught our suicide prevention training, and the very next day, he took his own life. 90% of suicide attempts involving a gun are fatal. My way of continuing my service is to help protect my community by being a responsible gun owner and by storing firearms safely. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council.
Timeout!
Oh, right! Remember, we're a team that plays together. Listen, the winning will take care of itself. We just have to get everyone involved.
In interscholastic sports, we celebrate what makes every one of us unique. And in the pursuit of a common goal, everyone in the huddle, in the bleachers, and in the community comes together. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Why are interscholastic sports called the last classroom of the day? Because they teach students important life lessons like teamwork, accountability, and perseverance. School sports are so much more than a game. They're about developing the whole person. That's why they're an essential part of every student's education.
Encourage your student to participate in the last classroom of the day. Interscholastic sports in Wisconsin. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Red Delicious, Honey Crisp, Granny Smith. If you have a favorite apple, now is the time to pick it straight from the source. Did you know Wisconsin has more than 300 apple orchards? Travel Wisconsin recently naming its favorites, including the Oneida National Apple Orchard outside Green Bay, Ferguson's Orchards in Eau Claire, and Apple Holler south of Racine. Many provide tons of family fun in the fall, too. Tire swings, lawn bowling, hay rides, and more. Apple experts suggest if you want to pick yours fresh, do it before the end of October. For Civic Media, I'm
and talking in these next segments here on Morning Cannoli is about the case pending in Georgia. This is a criminal case. It is being brought by a state prosecutor. Her name is Fonnie Willis. She's the DA in Fulton County, as you know well, bringing this major case, this sweeping RICO case against 19 people for various actions, various things that they did to try to stop the proper counting and the voting legitimately done by members of the voting population there in the state of Georgia. Just this past week, a major significant event in the movement forward on that prosecution. One of the defendants in that case among the 19 pled guilty to the offense conduct set forth against him in that plea, in that indictment against him, set forth in the plea documents presented to the judge. His name is Scott McAfee, who's presiding over all of this, and describing this as a negotiated resolution that bring us to the close this particular seemingly small but actually very significant aspect of the case. Scott Hall. Scott Hall, what is he all about? He is this Georgia bail bondsman who is charged in relation, again, to the alleged breach of voting machine equipment. We talked about this in previous broadcasts in the wake of the 2020 election, and that happened in Coffee County, Georgia. This very interesting part of the indictment coming out of Fulton County, focusing on attempts by various people, now including Scott Hall, to try to influence and affect and undermine the counting of votes in Coffee County, Georgia. And during the course of a hearing just this past week, again, in front of Judge Scott McAfee, the allegations surrounding this voting breach were pretty much laid out. It said that Hall and several of his co-defendants entered into a conspiracy to intentionally interfere with the 2020 election results. And their goal, according to the statements made in court, was to unlawfully access voting machines in Coffee County in order to obtain voting data. Goes on to say the conspiracy also included obtaining images of ballots. All of that is a part of the allegations. Now the convicted conduct. Now we can say that that conduct, the subject of a conviction against this singular defendant, against Scott Hall in this proceeding in front of Scott McAfee. Now, why is this important? Well, what happens in the wake of this is that Scott Hall, again, found guilty of these five misdemeanors. He is already sentenced. He is already sentenced to 5 years probation. And even that is significant. You might think, well, gee, what's going on here? Why is it that all this is happening now? How do you read the tea leaves on this? And the answer, I believe, is that Scott Hall is now going to testify against all the other co-defendants. That indeed is a part that's known. That is a part of his plea deal. He pleads guilty. The judgment is entered against him. He is sentenced to 5 years probation. And as a part of this negotiated resolution, as a part of this first plea in this case, he is now going to testify against other defendants. And why is that important? Well, he's connected to many other actors. And as you read through the indictment, that very long indictment in this case coming out of Fulton County, we know that he seemed to be sort of at the lower end of all these defendants involved, again, in this matter involving Coffee County. But it's also very clear. It's also very clear that he had an awful lot of connection to Sidney Powell. Sidney Powell, again, one of the attorneys also indicted in this case, also scheduled to go to trial very, very soon, according to Scott McAfee, along with a guy named Ken Chesbro. He knows a lot about Sidney Powell, a lot of the connections there, and presumably about others, okay, who's also involved in this. One of the others we've already talked about, his name, Jeff Clark. Jeff Clark, likewise, indicted in that state case, being told by the federal judge just this past week that the case against him will remain in state court. Scott Hall knows a lot about Jeffrey Clark. In particular, Scott Hall had an extended conversation, according to the allegations in the indictment, with Jeffrey Clark about ways in which the Department of Justice might become involved in trying to stop the vote, to undermine, to move the vote in a direction that's plainly inconsistent with what the voters there in Georgia had indicated. We've got Sidney Powell, we've got Jeff Clark, presumably others that Scott Hall could talk about, testify against. And as these cases go to trial, this matter involving the taking of the plea, the judgment that's been entered, he is now guilty. He has now been found guilty of the offense conduct in that case and now agrees to testify against others. Very significant. This is how these cases begin to play out. Probably not all the defendants will plead guilty, almost certainly not. One of those defendants we know well is Donald Trump himself. We've got the other indicted co-conspirators by name, including people like Sidney Powell, like Rudy Giuliani, like Jeffrey Clark. We'll see where this goes as well, but this is the first time that we've got among those indicted defendants someone coming forward being found guilty, a judgment entered, and significantly now agreeing to work with the state, the prosecutor, in presenting evidence against other defendants also on that list. Very significant issues coming out of Georgia and Fulton County just this past week. As always, we appreciate your phone calls, your comments, your questions coming into us here in the studios of Civic Media. And Joe, you're on the line today. Glad to have you with us from Madison once again, Joe. Good morning.
Thank you, Jim. I'd just like to return to the work that you were doing in the previous segment where you were talking about the New York case.
Yes.
and the summary judgment that the judge placed against Donald Trump in that civil case, in which, as I understand it, this use of a summary judgment, and you, as your background as a federal prosecutor, can perhaps enlighten me on this. I would assume that this is pretty rare, and that for a judge to issue a summary judgment, and I would assume that it's kind of like the judicial version of, are you kidding me? This is garbage. Yes. Get out of here. So I'm wondering if that sense is that it's rare, and I'm also, and you know, that the judge was just kind of appalled by the evidence. But the third thing I wonder is it possible that the defendants could look at this and go, you're just one person looking at this, and we don't agree. We want to have a trial by a, you know, a jury of our peers. Does that happen, or is that a ridiculous thought? I'm just sort of curious if a person would argue, a defendant could argue, well, you're just one guy, and I don't care about your opinion, Judge. I want a jury by my peers. Could you respond to that? Thanks
Absolutely.
A lot.
Absolutely, Joe, and as always, great questions, because it enables me to put on my hat as a former continuing civil litigator, but certainly inside the Department of Justice as well. I continue to do a lot of civil work in the courts, the state and federal courts here in Wisconsin. But formerly also was the civil division chief, both in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Milwaukee and also in Western Michigan many, many years ago, on a regular basis, invoking, Joe, exactly what you're describing. Let's talk even more about summary judgment. You've got it just right. It's basically, once again, this notion that you look at the facts and you say they're undisputed. Plainly, during the course of my term as a civil litigator for many, many years, a quarter century or so, would often file motions for summary judgment, again, in civil cases where, again, you convince the judge who's presiding over the case, that the facts are undisputed. And yes, it is rare, but rare with a small r. It does happen. Motions for summary judgment can, in fact, be granted with some regularity. It's not completely unknown. Right now, in a case I will not describe with great particularity, I'm working on a motion for summary judgment and responding to that claim about whether the facts are undisputed and the law is clear. So it does happen. But the reason why your question is so well pointed, Joe, is that usually, if there are some disputed facts that are material or significant to resolving the case, the judge will say, yeah, let's have a jury decide this. Let's have this go to a jury, because there may be some things, even maybe not central to the case, but around the edges, that could impact the result. That is the damages, the things that's got to happen after you make a decision about liability or about negligence, those kinds of things. Here, once again, the reason why this is significant is you've got the judge basically taking that, appropriately taking that decision from the jury and saying, nope, there's no reasonable juror, no reasonable trier of fact who could do this. And I am going to make that decision. I'm only going to send to the jury the issue of damages, how much money Letitia James, through her prosecution, the state of New York should get as a result of the fraud that Donald Trump and others have committed. So it is rare with a small r, but not unknown. And again, it is significant because of the procedural status of this particular case. Second, what about what happens next? Well, the answer is, of course, this pens in front of Judge Engoron, including the damages portion. There will probably be, even after a jury returns a verdict on the money portion of this, there will probably be motions after verdict for a new trial by Donald Trump and other petitions to Judge Engoron. And ultimately, when the case is completely wrapped up by Judge Engoron, probably sometime in early 2024, yes, indeed, Donald Trump, as a part of the civil process here, can appeal to the New York State Appeals Court that has jurisdiction over this particular case and this particular trial court. That's his next remedy, to pursue an appeal of these decisions, including the summary judgment order. Now, so the next question is, what are the chances that this gets overturned? Are they there? Of course they are. Appeals courts always appropriately take a look at decisions, especially ones like this, where there's a summary judgment order granted. They'll take a look at the damages amount imposed by the trial court as well. But here's the important point. If there is a sufficient basis for the judge to do what he did, if there's a sufficient basis for the trial jury to do what it is going to do in this case, courts of appeals generally defer to that, absent something extraordinary, something completely unsupported by the facts. They're not going to overturn that. And again, Judge Engoron has written this very, very lengthy opinion, great detail, great specificity, not only about the facts, but also about the law of the state of New York, saying, among other things, that the documents, according to Judge Engoron, do not say what the Trump attorneys say what they say. It says there's no such thing as objective value, the judge wrote, paraphrasing their arguments as he saw them. Essentially, the court should not believe its own eyes, is what Judge Engran said. And so, again, a very, very compelling case presentation made by the judge in the course of his order. Unlikely that even after all of this is done on appeal, this will be overturned. And again, the possibility to take it ultimately to the state Supreme Court, at some point this does come to an end. One more footnote before we go on this case and talk about the United States Supreme Court. In a footnote, and encouraged by Joe's very good question, Judge Engran also says, again, in connection with this notion that he should not believe his own eyes, that the documents are so compelling here, Judge Engran adds a line from the movie Duck Soup. It was uttered by Chico Marx, and he says, well, who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes? That's what Judge Engran says to Donald Trump in this case, again, decided in major portion just this past week. Joe, appreciate the comment question. Appreciate the very good civics comment made about what happens in this case. We will continue, of course, to monitor that along with Georgia, along with the matter in Manhattan, the DA case involving the hush money, and certainly the federal cases in the Southern District of Florida involving Mar-a-Lago and the documents there, and specifically the case in front of Judge Chutkan, the January 6th insurrection case, that also scheduled to go to trial early in 2024. Many more things happening there as well. A programming note here, and that is that we're going to spend some time next week in our broadcast talking, as I promised to Mark earlier, about this 14th Amendment issue that we have from time to time raised. Just this past week, yet another liberal group in Friday in Michigan filed a major lawsuit contending that Donald Trump under the 14th Amendment should not be on the ballot there. We've got other lawsuits. We're going to talk more about the 14th Amendment, those lawsuits that are pending not only now in Michigan, but also New Hampshire, South Florida, other places around the country. All of that having to do with the 14th Amendment and the insurrection that is described in the 14th Amendment, a prohibition on service after you've taken an oath to serve the nation if indeed you were involved in insurrectionist activities. We're going to talk about where that comes from and the theory that animates these lawsuits. We're also, again, at Mark's good invitation, we're going to talk about fake electors right here in the state of Wisconsin in our next broadcast, talking about the statutory bases for going ahead and filing a state lawsuit, an action under the state criminal law against the electors here in the state of Wisconsin, the basis for doing that, the prosecution authority in the attorney general, as Mark has indicated, the reasons why strategically that cannot be done anyplace in any other state court, certainly not in Michigan, not in Georgia, other places, could also be the subject of federal charges. We'll talk about the reasons why that would be wise or unwise, depending upon whether the federal government, the state government charges those, and the implications of prosecutions and convictions here in the state court, in the Wisconsin state court for those electors, for those other matters, specifically the matters pending in Georgia, but also in the federal government. You recall well that many, many months ago, the Attorney General of the United States of America, her name is Lisa Monaco, said that we're also looking, that is the U.S. Department of Justice, also looking at fake electors as a part of a potential future federal prosecution. Next week, we're going to talk about fake electors, the possibility, the options there, strategic and legal, constitutional and statutory, for charges here in the state courts in the state of Wisconsin. When we come back, we're going to talk about the United States Supreme Court, its term coming up. First Monday in October. Let me give you a little bit of a preview of what they're going to be talking about just this coming week. Stay with us for that important discussion right after this final break here on Morning Cannolis. Space and time keeps the galaxies in each
span. If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba,
please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
People won't give you the real talk on drugs, but it's time we know the facts. Fentanyl is killing people. It's a powerful opioid, often made illegally and commonly mixed with illicit drugs. It can even be pressed into counterfeit pills that resemble prescription medications. Just 2 milligrams, about the size of a few grains of sand, could potentially be lethal. This isn't an ad to scare you, but it is an ad to make you think twice. Get the facts. Go to realdealonfentanyl.com. This message is brought to you by the Ad Council.
If I could be you.
And you could be me. For just 1 hour.
If you could find a way.
To get inside.
Each other's mind.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
We've all felt left out. And for some, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe, and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Thank you for spending much of your Saturday morning here talking about these important issues in law, in government, and justice in America. First Monday in October, it's in about 48 hours from now. Presumably, the federal government will be officially, although not completely practically, shut down by virtue of what's going to happen in about 12 hours from now, which is the United States Congress defaulting under its obligations under the Constitution of the United States of America to keep us in operation. Many, many reasons to be very disappointed by our elected officials, and in particular those people in the House of Representatives who are preventing even some stopgap measure from going ahead. Presumably not going to stop the United States Supreme Court, however, for convening across the parking lot on Capitol Hill at the Supreme Court building, the beginning on Monday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time of the 2023-2024 term of the United States Supreme Court. Already, the United States Supreme Court has identified 23 cases on its docket. It's already granted what's called certiorari, which is the formal way, the Latin way of saying commanding the lower court to send up the materials, the package of litigation things amassed during the course of the lower court litigation. Supreme Court has great discretion in deciding what it will and will not hear. Cases already pending before the United States Supreme Court from many, many different circuits, 4 from the Fifth Circuit already. We talked about a couple of cases coming out of Alabama and Louisiana, those Fifth Circuit panels reviewing cases there. Also 4 from the Third Circuit as well. None from the Seventh Circuit officially yet, but we also anticipate that during the course of the weeks and months just ahead, the United States Supreme Court will continue to add to that body of 23 cases, probably about 40 or so more. Typically, they've been deciding by May or June of the coming year, about 60, approaching 70 cases or so. So many more cases yet to be added to that document. But this coming week, the court already has on its docket 3 oral arguments, 1 on Monday, 1 on Tuesday, 1 on Wednesday. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about those. Again, promise you that next week, we're going to spend a whole lot more time, in addition to reviewing this 14th Amendment issue I talked about, in addition to talking about fake electors right here in the state of Wisconsin. We're also going to spend some time academically talking about what else is on the docket of the Supreme Court, addressing cases like another voting rights matter coming out of South Carolina involving, again, line drawing there and gerrymandering allegations. We're going to talk about a case involving guns, a case called Rahimi that's also pending before the United States Supreme Court, and a case we chatted about last week involving the future of administrative review in a case called Raimondo and this Chevron doctrine that also implicates the position, the posture of Supreme Court justices when it comes to deciding that case, and in particular, deciding whether or not they have a conflict of interest based upon the allegations and the movements of the Raimondo case there as well. Clarence Thomas, of course, is the principal focus of that. All of that coming up next week and the weeks ahead. In the next few moments or so, let's talk about the 3 cases, all interesting cases that the Court of Appeal, the United States Supreme Court, has pulled up from the Courts of Appeals, but is going to be hearing oral argument beginning Monday morning. The first one has to do with a criminal prosecution under something called the Federal Guidelines, and in particular, the First Step Act of 2018. You may recall the First Step Act, this major piece of litigation, didn't really reform completely law enforcement in America, but made some significant changes to the federal sentencing laws under which federal defendants are sentenced today, and specifically under having something to do with the safety valve. It's not especially complicated, but it, believe it or not, has to do with whether or not and means and or means or. The Supreme Court is going to be talking linguistically about what and or means when it comes to interpreting the sentencing guidelines under the First Step Act. Important not only for the particular defendant, his name is Pulsifer, P-U-L-S-I-F-E-R, but also for other defendants being sentenced right here in Wisconsin, Illinois, other places around the country under the First Step Act and what the words mean, what the language means. Does or mean or? Does and mean and? What does that mean? Believe it or not, the Supreme Court is going to be wrestling with language in its first case on Monday morning. Second case, no less important, arguably even more important, goes to the very legitimacy, the continued status of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Remember, this is the entity created by Congress many years ago in the wake of the disastrous financial situation of 2007, the financial crisis of that time. The Dodd-Frank Act and the Consumer Protection Act were passed in Congress in response to that disaster at the time, creating the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. You may recall that Elizabeth Warren, a major advocate for that, authored this legislation that created this new agency in the federal government to protect the rights and interests of consumers. And a major case coming up for argument on Tuesday called Consumer Financial Protection Bureau versus Community Financial Services Association, in which the very legitimacy of the CFPB is under attack. The question is whether or not, because the CFPB gets its money not directly through an apportionment and an appropriation from the United States Congress under Article 1, Section 9, but rather through the Federal Reserve, whether that way of funding the CFPB is unconstitutional and makes the entire agency illegitimate and unlawful. A major case having to do with the future of this major piece of legislation and the constituency of the Consumer Financial Protection Act, obviously an attack on the CFPB, a Fifth Circuit ruling. Again, the Fifth Circuit once again finding that its funding source does in fact violate the Appropriations Clause. Our Supreme Court on Tuesday, on the 3rd, hearing oral argument about whether that's true or not, and about the future of the CFPB. And finally on Wednesday, a case called Atchison Hotels versus Laufer. The Americans with Disabilities Act, which we talk a lot about, again, passed many years ago, establishing all sorts of procedural substantive rights to ensure that people in our nation with disabilities have access not only physically but also to the procedural trappings of government and to life in America. All sorts of very good things done. Proud to enforce the ADA during my time at the Department of Justice. In this particular case involving Atchison Hotels, Deborah Laufer, who has a disability, claims that Atchison Hotels website inadequately describes the information that the hotel provides in terms of its ADA support and services. And under the ADA, there's a requirement that hotels do that. And the question is, Ms. Laufer, again, bringing this lawsuit, herself did not intend to stay in the hotel itself. She is a so-called tester, and she's done this in many other cases, about 600 other cases out there, where she's testing whether or not particular entities, including in this case hotels, are living up to the Americans with Disabilities Act. The question before the Supreme Court on Wednesday, whether or not somebody who is not intending to stay in the hotel nonetheless has standing. Once again, the standing issue, whether there's really been a specific amount of damage to her, whether she's got standing under the ADA to bring this lawsuit and maintain it as it goes forward. Three major cases coming up just this coming week. Pulsifer, CFPB, and Atchison. Look for them in reporting. And look for us next week again as we talk more about the Supreme Court right here on Morning Cannolis. As always, have a good week. Look to all of these cases, the rule of law, justice, and law in America. Thanks for spending this Saturday morning with me, everybody. Take care.
My dad has a cold, but also has high blood pressure. That's why I got him Vicks DayQuil High Blood Pressure for max strength daytime relief. Unlike some ordinary cold medicines, it's specially formulated for people like my dad. DayQuil High Blood Pressure is sugar-free, alcohol-free, and decongestant-free.
Vicks DayQuil High Blood Pressure. The daytime, non-drowsy, coughing, aching, fever, sore throat, cold, and flu for people with high blood pressure.
Like my dad.
Medicine. Use as directed.
Medicare open enrollment starts October 15th. Countless mailers and TV commercials will tell you you're missing out on some benefits. But don't be tricked into an Advantage plan you don't need or that doesn't cover your current medication. Wisconsin Senior Medicare Patrol can help you prevent, detect, and report Medicare fraud. Visit Wisconsin Senior Medicare Patrol.
You're listening to WLAK 1260 AM Amory and WBZH 910 AM W245 CT Hayward.
Always streaming on the Civic Media.